Clinton was in Brazil as part of her first visit to Latin America as Secretary of State. It also comes a week after Latin American and Caribbean nations agreed to form a new regional body, excluding the United States and Canada, as an alternative to the Organization of American States. At a news conference, Clinton criticized the Venezuelan government.
We are deeply concerned about the behavior of the Venezuelan government, which we think is unproductive with respect to its relations with certain neighbors, which we believe is limiting slowly but surely the freedoms within Venezuela, therefore adversely impacting the Venezuelan people. And we would hope that there could be a new start on the part of the Venezuelan leadership to restore full democracy, to restore freedom of the press, to restore private property and return to a free market economy. We wish Venezuela were looking more to its south and looking at Brazil and looking at Chile.
In Honduras, Human Rights Watch is warning of ongoing attacks against opponents of the coup that overthrew then-President Manuel Zelaya last year. On Wednesday, Human Rights Watch said at least three people have been killed and another eight jailed in what appears to be politically motivated attacks over the past month. The majority of victims were members of the National Popular Resistance Front, which opposed the coup and boycotted the vote that elected Honduran President Porfirio Lobo. The Washington Post is reporting the Obama administration is considering...
And that's it for Democracy Now! You can go to www.democracynow.org if you want to review today's Democracy Now! Or tune in on free radio, 8 o'clock, and I think it's at... I guess at 5 o'clock for Democracy Now! Coming up next, Bathrop's Piers Broadsides and your phone calls if you want to call in. It's Civil Rights in Santa Cruz, plus an update on the protests against the education cuts that happened today in downtown Santa Cruz. Stay tuned.
Guitar and a bit of time, little woman. I hope you're doing fine, little angel. Do any thoughts arise of inspiration up in the summer skies, little angel? Almost 20 years, I took the ball and ran. Why don't you spend?
And that was some of the street music that I picked up, gosh, a while ago. Spare and Change, Sitting Pretty with Mr. Paradise from about 11 years ago. I believe that was Little Woman, and then the beginning of Morning Song. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. I'm Robert. Name of the show is Bathrobs Piers Broadside. Sorry for the volume, folks. I think that's a little better. If, by the way, any time during this show I am too loud or too soft or too garbled, or too incoherent one way or another, please do call in and help correct me, 427-3772, or even present your own point of view, however much it may disagree with mine. You'll get at least some time to discuss the issues, particularly if we can talk about the issues that I'm really trying to focus on, which have to do with restoring civil rights in Santa Cruz and also popular sovereignty and the sense that people can actually make change instead of watch themselves get crushed by foreclosures, abusive ticketing, institutional police abuse, the war economy, the depression, and so forth. Call-in number here is 427-3772. And you're welcome to give a call. If you want to call me off-air, the number is 423-4833, 423-4833. That's 423-HUFF, HUFF. HUFF is Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, which is my main focus, which is on civil rights for poor people, both houseless and housed, but particularly houseless. Maybe having in the studio tonight Anna Richardson, Miguel de Leon, the two homeless musicians who face a court hearing, I believe it's March 19th, for seeking 5 days of jail for each instance of sleeping that they engaged in illegally in Santa Cruz, specifically three citations they were written for during the day for camping. And that's going to be an interesting case to follow because I talked to attorney Jonathan Gettleman, who's Anna Richardson's attorney today, and he was preparing a response to City Attorney John Barasoni, pointing out the fact that the good city attorney apparently is not only trying to get people jailed on crimes they haven't been convicted of, none of these tickets has been taken to court, but he also is bringing up charges, sleeping with intent to remain overnight, for which there's no evidence in the police officer's testimony. It's a complete, it seems like an appeal to prejudice or fear or perhaps his own connections with Judge Volkman, who will be dealing with this case in Department 2, as I understand it, on March 19th. So we're going to be talking with, Jonathan Gettleman may call in, Anna and Miguel may come in, and hopefully you and your calls. You can call in with comments and thoughts if you have them. Right now, however, I'm going to go back to tape from about an hour ago on Pacific Avenue. I was interviewing people when I started hearing this.
People with signs walking along the avenue, support our schools, UC tuition shouldn't go for construction. And coming up Pacific Avenue, now crossing the Regal Cinema 9, we have people who have taken the street with signs, no more cuts, they're shouting. We are the budget. We are the budget cuts, and they are walking, blocking the entire street, shockingly enough, and walking against traffic. We'll see if they continue up the street in their scofflaw manner. And we're talking about, let's say, 10, 20, 30, 40, maybe 50 people, all of them spread out so as to cover the avenue. Signs, democratize the regions. My future is not for sale. Underfunding education is unacceptable. No power like the power of the people, and the power of the people does. We have a young crowd here. Looks like students mostly. And I'm thinking UCSC students. We got a bicycle or two. Bicycles are being walked. One person is on a skateboard. Education matters. Stop the cuts. Here you are, a new demonstrator. You. What's your name?
Crux.
And what's been happening with this protest today? What are the issues?
The issues are we are paying more money for less classes, less education. The administration is taking more money and hoarding it and putting it into long-range development plans for a city that can't support that many more students. And it's just a misappropriation of funds all the way around the board.
Now, I understand these protests began yesterday in the rain.
These actually started this morning, early morning, to stop all activity of the UC Santa Cruz system by not allowing workers to go to work and granting them leave with pay for the day in a strike fashion.
How successful has this ever been?
Incredibly successful. We have the entire UC system shut down, one of the only ones in the state to be shut down for the day. We have Cabrillo Community College participating in solidarity walkouts. We have K through 12 and community members and staff members and workers and teachers and parents all participating in these protests.
Save EOPS. What is that sign? I noticed the sign. EOPS.
I'm actually not sure. It's education for underprivileged students. Right.
Got some sympathetic supporters along the side of the rally.
Yeah, that's what Santa Cruz is good for. Everyone seems to be sympathetic, but we need some more gusto, more action from these people, these community members that believe so staunchly in liberalism.
Now, is this supposed to go on just for one day, or is the university going to be shut down until real changes are made?
We want to disrupt the natural order of things and business as usual until things change, and that's our goal. Whether it happens or not depends on the rallying movement that we have behind us.
Now, I see mostly people who I kind of, you know, estimate are roughly between the ages of, I don't know, 17 and 25. Do you think there are any professors or instructors or...
We have all kinds of professors and staff members and workers in solidarity with us, on strike with us today, fully supportive. And we will only gain more once they see that these kind of measures are successful to a certain extent. If you just sit back and let things take over, then that's exactly what will happen.
So now, did this march begin from the town clock or from the university?
This started from the town clock and gaining more numbers, it seems like, as we go.
And are you going to do some sort of a tent city tonight or occupation, or is it...
There is a student put on by the Black Student Union that will be happening at about 6 or 7. There's going to be a general assembly up on campus at 5 o'clock, and the immediate action will be to go and sit in solidarity with Black Student Union for a teach-in, and then decide on a next plan of action after that, whether to continue the strike or to decide on another direct action.
Now, I will be doing a radio show at 6 tonight. Is there any message you want to put out for what places people should mobilize, join up, or go to a website for more information?
I would say look at OccupyCA at WordPress.com, .wordpress.com. And I would just say to everyone listening that don't take it lying down. If you want education, you have to get it for yourself. Take it for yourself.
And again, we've been talking with
Crux.
Thanks, Crux.
And the protest continues up the avenue from Cathcart on up to Laurel Street. Blocking the street. Shocking, shocking, said I to the host. Greetings. Yeah, I did, actually. So we have the quiet aftermath once the protesters have gone by. And so much for that.
See you tonight, Robert.
All right. Thank you. See you later. The music of Anna Richardson. And it's now about 5 o'clock, a little bit before, and those same questionable student marchers, and of course I'm speaking somewhat sarcastically, I'm always glad to see people out there.
of that kind, particularly against the kinds of cuts that are happening. They are coming back, coming down the avenue again, this time toward the town clock. And we have some musicians playing here near the sort of religious, nutrition-ish social event that it happens in front of Borders for Thursday afternoon. No, but thank you. Keep up the good work. I don't mean he's giving away religious propaganda, but heck. And we have other performers down here in front of the Pacific Trading Company with flute and guitar
and
hanging out and strumming. So how are times for musicians here in downtown Santa Cruz?
Any music for free radio?
I would say there is so much music for free radio. If they come down here on a Friday night to hang out in Santa Cruz and enjoy the street musicians and all the people playing. It's beautiful music here in Santa
Cruz. Do you have any songs you've composed about Santa Cruz that you play, or perhaps you're about to compose?
Song. Santa Cruz is the place to jam. We got a lot to do down on Pacific Avenue. Santa Cruz, come down and have some fun. Santa Cruz, we loving everyone.
Woohoo! Yeah. We're listening to the impromptu music of
Brendan Bros.
Thank you. And we have the protesters. We are the budget cuts coming back. Protect our future, save our schools. Limited access is not equal access. More signs and more younger folks have joined them. We have no education, no future. Governors say you cut back, we say fight back. Support public education.
This is
a God teacher with a big heart. And this looks like I think it's the same group that's been expanded with younger kids. Sign, get back to class.
Go back to class.
Andy, bringing out all shades of opinion here in downtown Santa Cruz. Although the crowd is definitely growing, when we walked the other way about 10 minutes ago. All right. So, hey, let me interview you for free radio. What's your name?
My name is Dave.
And, Dave, what brings you here today?
I'm marching for cheaper school.
And what do you want to see come out of this protest?
I want school to be less expensive.
And how can that be? After all, we're fighting a war overseas. We need you over there fighting away.
Oh, no. I need to go to school and be smarter.
But the army can train you.
No, I'd rather go to school.
Oh, for heaven's sakes. Well, we've been talking with...
This is Dave.
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
And again, we're now passing the Urban Outfitters at Church and Pacific. And what's your name?
My name's Veronica.
And Veronica, what's happening here? Your first protest?
It is my first protest.
And what brought you out?
I'm tired of getting ripped off by the government.
And what school are you attending, if any?
UC Santa Cruz.
And what year are you?
I'm in second year.
Yeah, are you from local or from out of the area?
I'm from Southern California.
And so are you going to be able to return next year if the cuts hit? What's your situation?
I will, but I need to find a really low budget housing situation.
And what about your family? How are they doing in Southern California?
We're doing pretty bad with the money right now, so that's why I'm here to help get some help.
Own your own home, or does your family?
We own it for now, so we'll see how that goes.
Again, we've been talking with...
Veronica.
Thanks, Veronica. Again, we're talking a significantly larger crowd. No divisions. K adult education together. Don't cannibalize education, I think it is. Stop privatizing education. So this looks like maybe a second protest has joined the first, or maybe it's an independent protest. So it looks like the lead banner is the same. And meanwhile, bringing up the rear, we have three police officers on motorcycles riding behind the group. So as I walk down Pacific Avenue
toward the town clock. I don't know. Past Zoccoli is here. I see protesters hanging there, some individually carrying signs, kind of leaving the protest, some still circling around at the town clock with signs, actually occupying the center of the road, blocking the area where you would normally enter Pacific Avenue from Mission and Water. And it's it's impressive they're not being harassed or hassled by police or even objected to by the citizenry, which may lead one to believe that there's a lot of support. Any comments for Free Radio?
No more cuts.
Thank you.
No
more cuts. Thank you. An actual white-haired guy who's at the protest. And it looks like the blockade is unblocking. Or actually, now they're blocking Mission. Science, education, everyone. Any comments on the protest?
Yeah, we fund it. We need more money in education.
Thank you. And it looks like some folks are leaving, whereas others are still marching about. And the protest is seemingly continuing. And again, it seems to be growing. I don't know, maybe people are converging on the town clock. There's a new banner, Solidarity. Cuts her kids. And a guy with a woman with a bicycle, a sign on the bicycle, education for all, end racism, no executive pay increase, many signs. And again, mostly students and young people, but some older folks. Our students need more. They're our future. Save our schools. And we're standing up for public schools. Barricades have been set up on the North Pacific between the town clock and the Scope of Scribner Park. And also looks like folks are blocking off still, kind of lingering in the middle of the Pacific Avenue entrance. Homeschoolers who support public education. What is this about?
What is this about?
Yes, tell us about it.
It's about the funding cuts. The government continues to take money from schools.
I see you're here with a shorter person. What's your name?
My name's Gabe. I'm actually homeschooled, but I'm still fighting for children's right to have no more budget cuts for schools.
And what's your name?
Julie.
And how long have you been homeschooled?
Pretty much all my life.
And is it a successful activity? Do you feel like you're learning stuff?
Yeah, I'm learning a lot. I get to be with my friends way more, and it's really fun.
And who's homeschooling you?
My mom.
Aren't you getting a little tired of your mom? Now, come on.
Sometimes, but it's fun.
When telling you, we are affiliated with the charter school, so the charter school is affiliated with the school district, so we continue to support the public school district.
Yeah, charter school.
Yeah.
So are a lot of charter school people here today, or?
You know, we haven't seen a lot, but hopefully it went through the internet that they would be here.
And you're here.
I'm here.
How can people learn more about this and about those in charter schools who support this whole process?
If they're interested in homeschooling, they just go online to California Charter Schools or call their school district, and they'll let them know about charter schools that support homeschoolers.
How about homeschoolers who support protests like this?
You're looking at her.
Yeah, I know. What about the rest of them?
I don't know where they are.
Well, you're here again, as I said before. And again, we've been talking with
Gabe Wooden
and Julie Wooden.
Thanks a lot. So we're talking 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 people maybe on the post office corner, another 20 or 30 here on the bank corner, over on the Scope Park corner, I see 20 people, and then at the town clock, probably 100, 120, 140 people. And again, people are now
crossing the street in consonance with the traffic lights so that presumably traffic will not be disrupted. Yeah.
Can I say something that I didn't say?
Sure.
One of the reasons why homeschoolers probably aren't here is because many people think homeschoolers take money out of the public school system because of the choice to homeschool. They don't know that we not all do that. Some of us are affiliated with the charter schools, and some of us reinvest in the public school system just because it's a choice.
Yeah!
We don't want to take away from the public school.
What percentage would you say are actually continuing to reinvest?
I would say 80%. I would say there's a very large percentage. There's at least 5 homeschool charter programs up in the San Lorenzo Valley.
And I wonder about the accuracy of that figure, but I haven't researched it. You're tuned to Free Radio 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. We're listening to the protests on Pacific Avenue at the town clock in support of folks wanting to change the priorities at UCSC and stop the budget cuts that are going on. I've gone directly to the Occupy California website, which that's occupyca.wordpress.com, where you can go to check out the supporters of the protest or a particular group that supports the protest. And there's a chronology of what's been happening today. 5 a.m., students out blocking streets at the intersection of High and Western, Hagar and Coolidge, and the western entrance of campus, effectively shutting it down. Only people on foot can enter campus. 7 a.m., some people have been hit by cars, breaking the picket line, breaking someone's leg, and hitting another 3 or so people. 8 a.m., campus administrators activated the Cruise Alert messaging system with the following message: please avoid both campus entrances due to safety concerns. 9:40 a.m., currently a rally is being held at the main entrance with 250 participants at the east entrance. For a while, 2 helicopters were flying above. The students blocking the intersection of High and Western have left after most of the workers were blocked from entering campus. It would appear some dining hall workers were able to get on campus, but many others were unable to get on campus. Many of the workers are now here supporting the students. Earlier this morning, multiple students were injured by 2 separate incidents where cars rushed the strike line, one at the intersection of Hagar, and Coolidge, and the second at the intersection of High and Western. The car at Hagar and Coolidge was tailgating a police car being let through. Students then approached the vehicle to stand in front of it and tell them about the strike. The car hit the gas and broke into the mass, injuring a student's leg, fortunately not broken. In the incident at High and Western, a tan Volvo began accelerating into the crowd, blocking the street, despite the fact that cars driving down High away from campus were being slowly let through. The Volvo hit around 5 students. One student flipped over the hood of the car and over the top, breaking the rear window as the student fell off the back. As the Volvo sped away, students kicked the car, denting it. Several cars and motorcycles have tried to slowly push through the crowd throughout the day, but all failed. Rumors of other car incidents exist, but the others have yet to be confirmed. Interestingly enough, if you go to the Sentinel website, that's the Santa Cruz Urinal, as I like to call it, or the Sent Anal, you instead get a different picture. And, of course, perhaps I'm unnecessarily prejudiced. I wasn't present at any of these incidents. I didn't interview anybody. But the Sentinel is big to talk about people who spray-painted destroy the university and destroy capitalism, about people being frustrated at not being given access to the campus. And around the car situation, Jeff Duncan, there were no major incidents on campus during the day, writes the Sentinel story online, but one driver at Western and High had his windshield smashed when he tried to turn from High Street to Western and would not roll down his window to talk to the student line. And then they quote a guy, Jeff Duncan, a facilities employee at Baskin School, said he'd given up going to work that day and was headed to town to get some breakfast. It's kind of ridiculous. I'm totally sympathetic with their cause, but I wasn't trying to get onto the campus, he said. He pulled over and talked to the UCSC police after the incident, implying that, I guess, Jeff Duncan was the individual in the car. Santa Cruz Police Captain Steve Clark, one of my least favorite police officers, said a UCSC police officer witnessed the incident but did not intervene. Whatever the intent of the message, it gets lost in the violence, Clark said. What does smashing this poor person's window have to do with whatever the cause is or whatever their intended message is? There were reports of knives and clubs by university officials at different sites and so forth. In other words, this is a very critical view of the protesters. And also, it's a very different perspective as to what happened with these 2 car incidents. It sounds like in the one case, you can say, well, you're looking at the Sentinel's perspective, here's a bunch of cars that were menaced by the one was unnecessarily vandalized by the students, yet the police were generously not intervening. But if you listen to the other, if you read the other account, the car crashed into the crowd, flipped a student over the car, which resulted in the window being smashed. Maybe it was a different incident. I don't know. But it's interesting. Toward the end of the story, you do get to read some of the concerns. One of the noon speakers was Santa Cruz Mayor Mike Rotkin, who, interestingly enough, I had a kind of a, well, we have both had segments on KQED FM yesterday morning, and it's archived on KQED FM about the San Francisco anti-homeless law being considered a sitting ban on sidewalks, like we have in Santa Cruz, only worse. But Mayor Mike Rotkin here, who also teaches at UC Santa Cruz, and I'm reading from the story on the Sentinel, also announced he'd been given a pink slip for July 1st. He spoke against the corporatization of the UC system. As to him, it had started to follow corporate values. He said the budget crisis in which state-funded cuts have trickled down disproportionately to students is not a budget crisis but a priority crisis. UC system administration members receive bonuses this academic year while cutting programs and staff. And one of the main concerns has also been the expenditure of money on buildings rather than maintaining existing programs or expanding them. This, again, if you can get contrasting views by going to the Sentinel website and then to occupyca.wordpress.com. 11:40, continuing from the CA website, or the Occupy CA website. While most of the protesters are at the main entrance and the west entrance, some of the protesters are at Hagar and Coolidge to watch out for supervisors forcing workers to trek up the long, steep hill to get to work. Supervisors began leading the workers up the hill past a handful of students in the intersection before the students could organize themselves. As more students came to support the other students in the intersection, they realized the workers and supervisors were already around 50 feet away up the hill to campus, so around 15 students ran up the hill to form a line to blockade the workers. The police arrived and dispersed the line, telling the students had made a physical threat on the workers. As the workers passed by, they shouted that there was no physical threat. So as the police returned to their vehicle, the students yet again ran up the hill to block the workers from getting further into the campus. The police immediately turned around and approached the students to disperse them. However, by now, the workers turned around and spoke to the supervisors, claiming they couldn't get through. The supervisors conceded, and the workers were allowed to go home. 1 p.m. Around 500 have rallied at the base of campus. Video below was taken around 12:45 p.m., and I think it's probably more useful video than my pedestrian stuff on Pacific Avenue. Here's a little bit of this.
When I say student, you say power. Student! Power. Student! Power. Student! Power. Student! Power. Student! Power. Student! Power. Student!
Power. Student! This is a video as well as an audio.
When I say worker, you say power. Worker! 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 Worker!
And you get the idea. Continuing again, reading from the Occupy CA website, 1:55 p.m., students are redistributing themselves around campus for maximum effectiveness. About 60 people are at Hagar and Coolidge, warning people that they may not be able to re-enter campus if they leave. They are also watching out for supervisors, forcing workers to get onto campus still. 2:50 p.m., strikers now relaxing on the grass, the main entrance, listening to a live band. The strike is mostly split up into three locations, lower campus, Hagar and Coolidge, main campus, the east entrance, and the west entrance. 3:20 p.m. earlier, story about a Prius running into students and driving onto the sidewalk at High and Western has been confirmed. At least one student broke some fingers when the car recklessly plowed through the crowd. There are also reports from UC Berkeley, UC Irvine, UCLA, UC San Diego, UC Riverside, UC Santa Barbara, San Francisco State, SUNY State University of New York, and other places. So check out that website if you're interested. You're tuned to Free Radio 101.1 FM, www.freakradio.org. And again, the concerns of the students are some of the specific concerns, at least, that some groups have. I'm looking to see an actual platform. And, of course, somebody wants to call in and talk about these specifics. March 4th, the Regents, how and why a movement gets co-opted. The Regents think it's a great idea. Blumenthal is beside himself. It's so great that the students are mobilizing to go to Sacramento. Student leaders are excited. The Regents are with us. Sacramento must listen. On the Regents' side, it's perfect. The shift to Sacramento solves two problems that the student movement poses. First, it gets the students off their backs, displacing the anger further up, the age-old tactic of bureaucrats. The removal of antagonism between students and Regents allows them to declare themselves on our side, which they, of course, could not do with the occupations or campus blockades, or when they needed busloads of riot cops with tear gas guns just to hold a public meeting. Second, it incorporates the movement, keeping it confined to sanctioned action. As soon as a coalition of student leaders, faculty, unions know how wonderful administrators unites in Sacramento, the path is clear. Lobbying, symbolic demonstrations, cliche as fuck chants, and picket signs. In short, a managed movement. Just as the university pits students against student workers, making them compete for limited resources, so now the state is now pitting all university stakeholders against prisoners and potentially against all other public programs. UCSA, the system-wide student government, is perfectly content to play this game, calling for a march for higher education starting with March 1st in Sacramento. This is an earlier story. Yes, the title is annoyingly snappy, but notice, too, that their version of the movement is reduced entirely to fighting for higher education, a mobilization that grew from a statewide conference of students, teachers, etc., of all levels of public education, an effort to build solidarity in order to combat the state's divide-and-conquer techniques, is now being commandeered to push for a slightly larger share of the pie for our little divided-and-conquered sector. Although I must say at the protest today, I saw young kids from public schools and private schools and charter schools. I don't know about private schools, but charter schools. So maybe this is not being successful and there is a broader movement happening. Again, this is an interesting website. You can go to it and check out the details at occupyca.wordpress.com. If anybody has any thoughts on this issue and how it might relate to those folks who are just trying to survive tonight, shivering in the cold, you can give us a call at 427-3772, 427-FRSC. Let's hear a little more of the protest, and then I will move on to my usual stuff.
So on.
All right, then we'll pass that on.
Thanks.
Thank you. We even have a city council member, Tony Madrigal, is here with a bullhorn. But does he have a permit for his bullhorn? So here we have a woman with a baby in the back. Why are you here?
We're here because we belong to Adult Education SoCal Co-op,
right.
And we're at risk of getting cut part of the adult education, and we believe in our public education system, and our children are this country's future, and we believe that everybody needs a fair chance at education.
So is this a one-day event, or are you going to be camping overnight?
We will not be camping overnight with our two children. One-day event. For
how old are your kids?
3 and 1.
Whoa. And again, we're talking with?
Isha Carroll.
Thanks, Isha.
Say Barry, you say power. Barry!
Power!
Barry!
Power!
I say children,
Tony,
you say power.
Leading the cry.
Children!
Power!
Children!
Power!
I say school, you say power. School!
Power!
School!
Power!
I say picket, you say power. Picket!
Power!
Picket!
Power!
And I say rally, you say power. Rally!
Power!
Rally!
Power!
And I say labor, you say power.
Enthusiasm here. I'm not usually a big fan of Tony Madrigal's, but I'm glad to see anybody doing this.
Are we united?
And actually, I'd like to kind of take that back. I don't think it takes a lot of courage. In fact, what it really shows, you're trying to use these crowds by these kinds of tactics, or it could be that way. I don't know. Tony, as a labor organizer, has never been terribly heralded by cutting-edge union activists that I've talked about. As a Citizens Police Review Board member, he was horrible. As a council member, he has not been particularly noteworthy. And a course, as a person on homeless issues who's been horrible. So it's hard to, one has to judge every, you know, every new situation as it comes up on its own merits. So I invite people to do that.
Cars are honking. A lot of moms and their kids are here. Almost, I don't know, every third woman, well, every fourth woman has a child, maybe. Anyway, a lot of children. That's probably an exaggeration. On the other side of the street, a large sign on the barricade: "Save public education. Save our community." And people are coming.
Okay,
well, mostly people are going, but there are people. A lot of people are still here, so it's impressive. And in the distance, as I walk away, you can hear "Si se puede," if we can. Yes, we can. Meanwhile, lingering and not a part of the protest, but on the phone, it's the former council member Chris Krohn. Chris, are you supportive of this protest?
Yeah, I better go, man. Somebody's trying to
interview you.
Trying to harass me.
No, interview you. Interview you.
Take care, man.
He's actually on the phone. So, have you been marching with the marchers, Chris?
What did Phil Oakes write? I'm not a marching anymore.
He's not a marching anymore. So that
I was up at the base of campus. I was here at the town clock. It's good stuff. It's kind of like what labor has. You know, you only have your labor power, your bodies.
Well, you have your dog with you.
Oh, my dog.
On the mall without a permit, I might add.
No, not on the mall. If you're
side streets are included, Chris. I'm sorry. Going to have to ticket you. A citizen's arrest might be appropriate. Actually,
I thought you were going to lay off me, Robert.
Well, I don't know. I'm still waiting for your public apology for past behavior.
This is good stuff. You know, I as a parent, I got actually two emails this week. First, unprecedented. People trying to organize all of the students and parents of public schools to come out here today because, you know, we're in a grave situation. We're going to cut all of our aides at Happy Valley School.
And whether next, it was a decision made about 2 days ago by the school board, right? I believe it was either last night or the night before.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. And that's how they're going to save money and balance the budget is cutting the aides. And the aides are, like, critical in most of the classes because, you know, what teacher can teach 30 kids? I'm a teacher. I have a credential. I've been there. And you're always going to have 5 to 7 kids in the class that are not going to be with the program.
Is this a one-day protest, you think, or is there going to be a continuing thing like the Tent University or some other ongoing event?
Well, me and you would wish for that until they change their mind.
And at this point, perhaps mercifully, I ran out of tape. After that, Chris began making more controversial comments about, you know, the one important issue downtown being the most important issue being the new city manager and the misdeeds of the city attorney and his profligate waste of money. And he wondered how much money the city was wasting on the actually the case in which he's involved, which is the case where he had me arrested for the mock Nazi salute at city council. That's been over $100,000 that the city has spent justifying its arrest of me for refusing to leave the council after he insisted I do so. And so far, no apologies for that, no acknowledgement that the rules of city council need to be changed so that silent, clear expressions of dissent are not treated as criminal activity or the basis for excluding people. He also said that the issue of the city manager and the upcoming new city manager after Dick Wilson, our current city manager, will be retiring, I guess, in July to a fat pension. Actually, I don't know what his pension is going to be, but I'm frankly imagining it's a fat pension. So let me say that's what my suspicion is. I've invited him to come into the studio, not Dick Wilson, but Chris Krohn, and talk about this in more detail, amount of money that was wasted by the city attorney and by the city manager, but to no avail, as usual. We do have a caller here on the air. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Robert.
Hey, Robert, this is Jonathan Gettleman. I just gave my little daughter a bath, and I thought I'd call in while I have a minute.
Excellent, excellent. Jonathan Gettleman, you are, in fact, You've been following, at your own expense, the case of Anna Richardson trying to squeeze some documents out of the city attorney around the issue of sleep crime. Why don't you tell the community what this issue is all about?
Well, I feel more like this case has been following me than I've been following it. But to some degree, the whole case started when the city instituted what would be a process of getting an injunction against what is otherwise a crime. And I guess the way that they did that was that they declared homeless people sleeping in public as a public nuisance, and therefore they went to the court to get an injunction to abate or stop this nuisance behavior. We challenged the injunction and were successful on a lot of fronts, but the one aspect of the injunction that held out was the sleeping ban as it applies specifically in the downtown area.
Now,
go ahead.
The Sentinel, which covered this, well, or which had its own perspective on this last spring and summer, seemed to paint Anna Richardson and Miguel de Leon, the two homeless musicians who are involved in this injunctive attempt by City Attorney John Barisoni, as, people bathing in the fountain and trespassing on private property and engaging in other kinds of behavior than simply trying to sleep somewhere legally at night. And yet you say that none of these charges became the basis for the injunction. The only thing that was enjoined was the act of sleeping after 11 o'clock at night in the downtown corridor. Is that right?
Well, it was the entire sleeping ban. So sleeping, setting up bedding, or you know, any of the other acts that fall under 6.36010, the municipal code of Santa Cruz, which is basically the sleeping ban.
And yet, this is a law that is citywide, right? I mean, it's illegal everywhere in Santa Cruz to sleep. Did the city attorney or the judge that pushed this order, Judge Burdick, I believe,
right,
did he offer some place where these two could go? During the summer, there's no resources at all for walk-in resources. The Paul Lee Loft is full.
I don't think offering a place for them to go was within the scope of what the court felt was their responsibility.
So the
question
court
is, were they violating the municipal code in this area that was causing a public nuisance? If yes, I issued the order. So that's what happened to how we've got to the place where we're at now, where we're waiting for the trial on the matter, but this preliminary injunction or an order to stop sleeping downtown while the civil process is proceeding was issued, and that is the basis of the kind of fight that we're in now.
And that injunction was issued way back in, what, May or June?
May 29th of 2009.
And so they're expected not merely, you should probably turn down your radio, by the way, because I can, you're probably going to get confused with that echo. They were expected not merely to, they were expected not to sleep at night anywhere in the city of Santa Cruz on public property and on pain of jail, not to sleep in the downtown corridor area.
Well, that pain of jail is an interesting point that you bring up. I mean, at this point, it's kind of hard to fathom. But in addition to seeking jail for what is otherwise through the injunctive process, so let me just give a little background and then we can get into that. So the city goes and gets an injunction, and the consequences for violating the injunction is violation of a court order, being charged with violating a court order. And the court, pursuant to the civil procedure for violating a court order, can have a penalty of up to 5 days in jail for each count, and after three counts, some amount of community service. I think it's up to 240 hours or something. So that's the civil process. There's also a criminal misdemeanor process are violating court order two. The problem with the civil procedure is that it doesn't afford you the same rights as you otherwise get in a criminal court, even though you're facing jail. So what John, well, what the city attorney's office anyways is seeking to do is through this injunctive process, they're attempting to jail my clients for acts that are not authorized to be jailed by the legislature. So basically, calling it a violation of a court order instead of what it is, which is a violation of the camping ban, they are attempting to, one, get 5 days in jail for each count. For each of them is 3 days, so that's 15 days in jail. Then because they each have three counts, three being the magic number, the city attorney wants them to do 240 hours of community service. And then finally, in all I can just characterize it as is just mean, the city attorney wants my homeless clients to pay for the city's attorney's fees for bringing this injunction against them. So that's where we're at now. I'm now in the position of attempting to defend in this quasi-criminal civil process my clients from going to jail.
How much would that be, Jonathan Gettleman? How much would that be to pay for your for the city attorney's fees in your estimation?
Well, I would imagine that the city would have to narrow their request for fees if it were even possible. I mean, it's just a ridiculous thing to ask for because my clients are obviously completely insolvent. They are homeless and have no funds. So it doesn't matter if it's $1 billion. They can't pay it.
But how much is the city forking out for this bizarre process of saying, we're not going to charge you with a crime, even though we have a law. We're going to kind of circumvent this whole process and consider you a public nuisance under a civil procedure, which apparently doesn't even require there being appointed an attorney. You just happen to volunteer, right?
That is a gray area, because I've been doing some research on this, because all contempt citations from a court are quasi-criminal. Technically, you're supposed to get the same types of rights that you would in a criminal action. However, you definitely do not have a right to a jury, and you also do not have a right to an appeal. In the way that an appeal is commonly known, a review of the trial process.
But in the initial making of the injunction that then sets you up for when you violate it, you get, you know, a hearing.
You definitely don't get an attorney for the issuance of the original injunction.
And
the question is, when the injunction is enforced through an order to show cause why you shouldn't be held in contempt, the question is, when that process is channeled through the civil procedure, whether you get appointed an attorney at that point, and that is unclear.
Right, but in fact, by the time that comes around, even if you get an attorney, the injunction is in place without you having gotten the benefit of an attorney to defend you. Although in this case, Anna Richardson and got you, and Miguel De Leon got Mark Briscoe.
Right.
Because you both happen to know them.
The California Supreme Court provides that you have the right to challenge the legality of any court order, pursuant to the contempt procedure. So the legality of the order is an element of the contempt crime.
Right.
Although, that makes sense.
But the original order, there was no attorney available to challenge it at that stage. It has to be challenged once the cops have written you tickets, once the city attorney has decided to throw the book at you. Then suddenly, I mean, as I understand it, you were kind of waiting for June for a hearing on whether this injunction, which they passed as a preliminary injunction last May, was going to become a permanent injunction. And suddenly you were told that on March 19th, City Attorney Barrasoni wanted to have these two, you know, serve 15 days in jail each and 240 hours of community service. And then, again, I as I understand it, this costs tens of thousands of dollars for the city so far, given the...
Well, the whole process has to be at least that much. In terms of, we're supposed to have a trial on the injunction.
And they would have to pay that.
Which is not a jury trial, it's a court trial. But the trial is on, I believe, starts June 14th. So one big problem with this contempt procedure right now is that we don't have, I was just told today that we can come get our discovery, which is, you know, 900 and some pages. We're obviously going to not have the benefit of the use of that discovery in challenging the contempt proceeding, and it's unclear to me if the judge rules that this proceeding, that the original injunction was legal, why we're even having a trial. I mean, it appears as though the judge has already made his decision before the trial, which is a little disappointing.
Now, clarify, why do you? We're talking about Judge Volkmann here, right?
Right.
Why do you feel the judge may have made a decision before the trial?
Well, because as one of the elements of the contempt proceeding, he is going to have to determine whether the injunction is legal or not before the trial.
Well,
the whole trial is to determine whether the injunction is legal.
Well, then why do you? But might he not have entertained some doubts about that? I mean, why do you feel he's made a decision beforehand?
He will have to make a decision holding the injunction legal in order for my clients to be held in contempt, because the legality of the order is an element of the contempt charge.
But isn't the legality of the preliminary injunction already a decided matter as of last May when it was essentially imposed by Judge Burdick?
No, it's not, because it is an element of the contempt. The judge in the contempt proceeding has to find that injunction was legally issued in order for my clients to be held in contempt.
Now, you're a man who's defended these kinds of civil injunctions in the past?
Yes.
So you're not just talking either theoretically or hypothetically. You're actually talking from your actual experience in California before Santa Cruz courts or another court?
In terms of what aspect of it?
Well, in terms of this question I just asked you, which is...
It's definitely true, and based on my research, that in order for the court to jail my clients and hold them in contempt, an element of that crime of contempt of court is that the contempt is based on a legally issued order. So the court has to determine that the initial injunctive order was legal before it can make my clients responsible for it. Because wasn't legal, then they don't
right.
have any
but
reason to have to follow it.
But the order was issued by a fellow judge, Judge Burdick, after a hearing at which you contested as City Attorney Barrasone, and I don't know if your clients were allowed to testify or not, but or whether they chose to testify or not, but there was a hearing. So wasn't the determination of legality made at that point by Judge Burdick?
It has to be made again.
Now, does that mean there'll
be
like a? Does that mean it'll be like a two-tier hearing coming up on? I guess it's going to be on March 19th.
If I have my way, it will be a multi-tiered hearing.
That
will be one tier.
Are you suggesting that Judge Volkmann is somehow? I mean, why are you suggesting he's made up his mind beforehand? He may be in fact.
No. You misconstrued.
Ah, okay. Well, clarify it for
me. What I'm saying is that he is going to have to make that determination prior to the trial, one way or the other.
And the trial
the trial's in June, and the issue is being forced on March 19th.
Right,
so one way or another, on March 19th, in order to either hold my clients in contempt or not hold them in contempt, he's going to have to determine the legality of the injunction, and that's the whole
and as part
basis
of, that,
of why we're having a trial in
June. As part of that process, you will be allowed to make arguments, presumably, about its legality or lack of legality, right?
Yes, because it's an element of the crime. Yeah.
So, again, you know, we spoke about this earlier today, and I've always thought this costly process seems to be more like a PR bow to the, I don't know, downtown association or conservative council members like Matthew and Robinson and, Coonerty, than any kind of real substantive addressing, even the concerns of, legitimate concerns of some merchants and residents about, I don't know, bad behavior by some people outside in the downtown area, or just, you know, maybe even their desire to be rid of homeless people sleeping at night in the downtown area, even though there's no legal place for them to go. It doesn't seem to be an effective response because they've been, Anna and Miguel have been They've testified on this radio show that they've been outside sleeping at different points, and the police have contacted them. Mostly they've tried to stay out of the downtown corridor, but the police have pursued them to other places in the city, taken their stuff, and so forth. So,
right.
It's not...
I would defer to you on what the, you know, motives of the city are in this regard, but what I can say is that one of the initial problems when this injunction was issued, preliminary injunction was issued way back last year in May, was that, you know, the question I posed to the judge is, if it's illegal to sleep anywhere, then what is the purpose of specifically forbidding them to sleep downtown? When, even though you can say, well, can't they just not sleep downtown? Yes, but they can't legally just not sleep downtown. They can't legally sleep anywhere outside. So that brings us back to an essential point, which is also an element of contempt, which is, can they comply with this order in a manner that is legal? And that's questionable. But one thing that is interesting to me that has come to my attention, based on the reading of the citations that were issued and form the basis of this contempt charge by the police, is that it appears police are interpreting anybody with there that is homeless and necessarily carries all their possessions with them, including possessions that involve sleeping and eating and all the other things, that any stopping of those people with all their possessions around them can be considered setting up a campsite, which is kind of phenomenal, because then that means that it's basically illegal to be sedentary and homeless, because all of your things are going to be with you. So there are going to be blankets there. There are going to be foodstuffs. There are going to be things like that. And so I don't know. You know, my clients have done the very best that they can to comply with an order that they don't agree with. I believe it's unconstitutional, for reasons that I haven't even raised at this point. And they're trying their best to comply. The tickets weren't issued in the nighttime. They were just issued in the day when they're just sitting on a blanket with their stuff around them in the downtown area. I mean, are they to understand that they're not allowed to be downtown at all? Because that's certainly not what the court said.
Interesting. Were the same police officers issuing the citations, or were they from three different officers?
They were from three different officers, but all downtown beat officers.
Now, were these, normally when citations for sleeping or camping, and the sleeping ban has three sections, or the camping ordinance has three sections around this specific issue. If you sleep after 11, set down bedding after 11 or set up bedding, or if you set up a campsite with the intention of remaining overnight at any time, those are all crimes. The first two are only limited infractions, not punishable by jail. The third, if you do it more than twice in 24 hours, is punishable as a misdemeanor. And, of course, all of them are punishable as misdemeanors if you don't attend to the infractions and you don't deal with the citations, which I guess is going to be an issue. I mean, I take it that Anna and Miguel did not go in and deal with these three tickets. They didn't take them to court within a month or two, as they were supposed to do, right?
Well, that is charged here. There is no accusation of Anna and Miguel either getting citations for camping 2 days in a row. There is no citation for them not taking care of their tickets. There's only this sleeping in public. And one thing that I would like to mention while I, you know, have an audience is that it's really important for people to realize that the democratic process in Santa Cruz, for whatever reason, has determined that people cannot go to jail for sleeping outside or violating the camping ordinance unless it is under specific conditions that aren't charged here, which is 2 days in a row or having tickets that you're not addressing. But what my clients are, what the city is attempting to punish my clients for is precisely that. So if they want to change the law, and by all means, I'm not suggesting to them that they do, but if they want to change the law and go through the democratic process that it takes to change the law in order to make repetitive sleeping outside a terrible offense, then they should do that. But it is highly undemocratic and not becoming of the city attorney to put himself in the place of that entire democratic process and say, I am going to attempt to punish you, Anna Richardson, and you, Miguel De Leon, greater than anyone else can be punished for this crime, because I think it is warranted. It's just not how government functions. So that's going to be a major issue.
Well, you know, I didn't think much of the process by which the original sleeping ban was passed or its various modifications. So I can appreciate the theoretical argument you're using about a theoretical democratic process, which is actually heavily weighted in favor of the police department and certain interest groups downtown. But I catch your drift that this is violating even the forms of democracy. Even if we don't get the substance of democracy, we aren't even seeing the forms of democracy or even the legislative process as it is supposed to be constituted at the local level. But, you know, I mean, let me be the devil's advocate here and say to you, when were these three citations issued for? What are the approximate dates of each of the three criminal acts of camping?
October 2009, January 2010, and February 2010. So it's not like this is all happening in a week either. I mean, this is over the course of a six-month period, is it? There's three citations for camping for two people that are homeless. And under the great scrutiny, specifically those two, of the police department. I mean, yeah, how hard is it? Actually, to only get three citations if you sleep outside every night.
Well, it sounds like, and these are citations within the forbidden zone of the downtown corridor that was specifically enjoined by Judge Burdick way back in May, right?
Well, even that. I mean, that's a real challenge, especially when they earn their livelihood downtown, and especially for the sake of Anna Richardson. I mean, let's face it, it is not safe to sleep in the woods if you're a young woman. It's just not. Especially not on a consistent basis.
You know, in my interviews with the two of these folks, I found them pointing out that they usually did try to sleep outside the zone, the downtown zone, though, as you said, they needed to be, you know, relatively close to downtown, but they're inside the area where it's illegal to be, but outside the area where it's a jailing offense to be under this very unique, we're going to get you to, John Barisoni, you know, injunction that was put forward. But the issue I have for you here is in October and January and February, and that's not that long ago, so it's kind of hard to call these unattended infractions. You're saying they aren't being charged, but, you know, it seems to me that's certainly a cheaper process.
I don't know if they're being charged or not.
Haven't been told they've been charged.
What I can say... Okay, I don't know that I haven't been told, no.
What I'm saying is they haven't been charged with the crime of three unattended infractions, as far as you know.
No.
Now,
no.
I think it's very interesting
because...
But let me finish this first,
okay,
Jonathan,
sorry.
because this is, seems to me, I mean, they passed this law a year ago. It's a bad law. You know, it makes any three mistakes or any three harassment efforts by police officers for sitting down or, you know, playing a musical instrument or, you know, downtown. And if you have a heckler's complaint or leaving your property a moment while you go to the bathroom, these are crimes in Santa Cruz. It makes any three of such citations, if you don't go through the process of making a court date, getting into court, dealing with them, that can become a misdemeanor. Now, I haven't actually heard of any and this law being used. Maybe it has. Maybe you have. But this could certainly be a case, since these two are considered the arch criminals, the arch sleep criminals of Santa Cruz. This could be a case where all John Barisoni has to do as city attorney is say, these three citations have not been addressed. Therefore,
right.
You
well,
know, here's a misdemeanor charge. Misdemeanor is punishable by up to, you know, 6 months in jail and $1,000 fine. And it's a much cheaper process for the city than the civil injunction, isn't it?
The problem is that statute that you're talking about was passed after the any issues that Ann and Miguel had with not showing up for court. I mean, the only way that the charges that you're talking about can be converted...
No, it's not. No, it's not. October 2000... The law was passed in January 2009. It went into effect in February 2009. And these charges date from October 2009, January and February 2010, if they didn't show up for those court appearances.
That's only if those citations were... Well, I don't... First of all, I don't know that they didn't show up. Second of all, I don't know that they were, like you said, I don't even know if they were even brought to court process.
But, I mean, he obviously knows those citations were issued, unless he's claiming...
It's not a matter of whether they were issued. The matter is whether they go to court and don't appear and
right.
don't address them.
Well, they
and that's not clear that those are the facts.
Well, it may not be clear, but it's, I suspect it didn't happen in the October citation. I suspect it didn't happen in the January citation. And the February citation, it probably... I mean, I haven't heard of them going to court. They may have gone to court. I'm not trying to undercut your case. I'm trying to point out, though, that the city attorney had other alternatives to use, and instead he's using this bizarre injunctive process, which you point out particularly criminalizes these two people by creating, because that's what an injunction is, almost a new law. A court order is saying the law isn't enough. We have to make a very specific kind of order that acts as a law, right?
Well... I honestly don't know what in the world my client did to draw the ire of the city attorney in the manner that they have, first of all. I don't know. Second of all, we are not pleased with the fact that these problems that the city attorney perceives with Ms. Richardson and Mr. DeLeon have been channeled through... One, through the injunctive process, and then two, through this quasi-criminal civil contempt proceeding where they don't get types of rights, or at least all of them, such as the right to a jury of your peers, or the right to an appeal of the decision. They don't get those types of rights. And it's interesting, because on each of the citations, the police officers suggested and recommended that the violation of the court order be charged as most other violations of civil court orders are, like a violation of a family law stay-away order, you know, when you're required to stay away, you're ordered to stay 100 feet from somebody. If you violate that order, those are charged as a crime. It's misdemeanor under the Penal Code 166, and you have a criminal process, you know.
Right to a jury trial, right to an attorney.
Right, and all those things. So why they're choosing to use this mechanism and why they have such a fixed attention on our clients when there are a lot of people violating the sleeping ban, I don't know, but it is extraordinarily expensive. One thing that I think might be the issue is I don't think that this county prosecutor really cares about these infractions very much. You know, I mean, I don't know that to be fact, but I do know that they have a limited amount of resources, and based on what they're dealing with every day, this isn't a huge deal. So I don't know, maybe the city needed a test case to push the issue or something like that, but it's just very dangerous because as I understand it, this process can happen without the person who is, you know, having this contempt being present.
Or even knowing about it.
Until it's over. So,
yeah, you mentioned that.
That's scary.
You mentioned another attorney had found that one of her clients was, you know, convicted of, was given an injunction against panhandling, and then, you know, didn't even know that he was being taken to court on a violation of that injunction. He just ended up in jail without even being present at his hearing, right?
Right, because the warrant issued after he was held in contempt. But you know, I'm not exactly crystal clear on that because that wasn't my case. But that's my understanding that.
Yeah, we'll find out about
happened,
that. We were looking into.
This happened. A warrant issued, and then you know, off he goes.
You know, I think I see, you know, I had said before that this seems like a costlier process, this civil process, but I begin to think maybe it isn't a costlier process, and maybe that's the reason that City Attorney Barisone is using it, because he doesn't need to impanel a jury. And indeed, he doesn't need a district attorney to prosecute this. He can prosecute it. The city attorney can prosecute these cases. I mean, it has been done in the past. And well, you know, because it's a misdemeanor under the city code, not under the state code. I mean, you know.
Well, one thing that is definite is that I would say 99.99% of the time, people don't have attorneys that fight these cases. So, you know, they go in, they get an injunction, there's no attorney allowed at that, or provided for anyways at the public expense. At that stage, they get their injunction, the person does what they think is, you know, in violation of the injunction, and then they have these enhanced penalties. And typically, that's probably the way that it goes.
I mean, one wonders if a jury would convict two homeless musicians of the crime of sleeping to start with. I mean, that would be a hard one to get past a jury, and that would be, the reason, particularly in a town that has no adequate shelter facilities, covers only 5 to 10% of the homeless population. And I think that, you know, I think that may be one of the reasons, and I'm going to backtrack a little bit here. While it is true the city can prosecute misdemeanors, if you're violating an injunction is a state law, so that may require the involvement of the district attorney, and the district attorney may want to, get involved with the jury in this. So this may be Barisone's motivation. He's going to get this done kind of on the sly. He just says, okay, we'll have a civil injunction hearing. We don't need even to let the people know it's happening, though of course they will, because he knows you're involved, and it's gotten some publicity, and some homeless advocates are involved. So it may be that, however, at least he doesn't have to confront a jury. He doesn't have to coax the DA into dealing with the case. He doesn't have to even himself take the case before a jury for charging three unattended infractions in what would be the first trial I have ever heard of under that year-old law.
Yeah, I don't know exactly what Mr. Barisone's motivations are, but what I do know is that the process that he has chosen seems to have some real pitfalls in terms of the types of rights that people in this country have come to expect when they're charged with criminal acts. So, you know, we're going to try our very hardest to get rid of this mechanism so that he cannot, circumvent the kind of constitutional rights that people otherwise have.
And, right on.
You know, one of the issues with the camping ban that makes it challenging to prosecute in, you know, a court is the fact that for the aspect of the camping ban, which is setting up a campsite, for you to be found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt of that, the prosecution, or the, in this case, the city attorney, has to prove that your intention in setting up the camp was to stay there in that location overnight.
Right. This is, for people, people should understand who are listening to this, that this is not the sleeping ban or the blanket ban sections of the camping ordinance, which most people are charged with, in which you don't have to prove the intention of remaining overnight. You just have to prove the person was either asleep or covering up with blankets after 11 o'clock at night before 8:30 in the morning. Anna and Miguel, on the other hand, are being charged with the third section, which requires the intention to remain overnight, but it can be charged at any time of the day or night. And it was actually charged against them during the day, right?
Right. One was at 8:30 in the morning, one was at 5:30, and one was at 1:40 or something. And so,
and there's no indication there's no indication in the police reports that in any of these instances either of them said, "Hey, I'm staying overnight."
Right. Or there's no. I don't even know how you would go about proving that, because a homeless person is laying with all of their possessions, even if they're on a blanket, at 1:40 in the afternoon, that they plan to be there overnight. And maybe that is a reason why, this process is being utilized, because, you know, the burden of proof, you know, the trier of fact is one person. You don't have to have 12 people agree this is a violation of the law.
I mean, also, isn't it true the standard of proof is different? I mean, if you're in a criminal trial, it's proof beyond a reasonable doubt, right?
Well, it's proof beyond a reasonable doubt in this proceeding.
Oh, it's not preponderance
well.
Of the evidence or no. Clear and convincing or anything of that sort. Okay, then the standard is still the same, though. So the judge has...
The same. You have the right, you're supposed to at least, have the right to cross-examine witnesses and, you know, compulsory process to make people come to court and testify if you need them to, and you should also have the right to counsel. I mean, you're supposed to have... all the rights that are afforded to a criminal client except or criminal defendant except for the right to a jury and the right to a direct appeal. But the problem is, especially my concern with the court, is that to some degree the pump is already primed. I mean, a judge in the Superior Court has already ruled that this injunction is illegal. So
Judge Burdick, you mean?
Judge Burdick, right. So,
but you're saying there has to be a second ruling.
It's going to be challenging for us to convince, you know, the next judge down the line that Judge Burdick was wrong.
Right. What kind of arguments did you use in Burdick's court that failed, but that might, and what kind of arguments, either they might succeed in Volkman's court, or there might be new arguments you're using, or do you wish to reveal your strategy at this point?
Well, it was a different... It was a different process in Judge Burdick's court because we were trying to rule that there wasn't a basis for the injunction, and I don't think we're going to get into all that. I think that we're going to attack the process, and you know.
What do you mean you're going to attack the process?
Well, we're going to attack the process. I think that there are fundamental flaws, and without getting into too many technicalities. There are fundamental flaws with the way that the city attorney is going about attempting to incarcerate two specific people for crimes that one cannot be incarcerated for.
Did you use this argument in Judge Burdick's court as well or not?
No, because it wasn't ripe for arguing at that point because it was the issuance of the injunction. This goes more to the possible penalty that can be faced. The judge can, and, you know, if he were to find a violation of the injunction, I think that he could probably fine them. You know, he could do that. But what he can't do is increase the penalty pursuant to some civil contempt process further than what the legislature allows people to be punished for. So this process should be in a criminal court. It's a criminal charge, basically seeking punishment for violation of a court order, which is a violation of Penal Code Section 166. And this civil injunctive process just seems like a way to circumvent what would otherwise be, the affording of all the criminal rights somebody would normally have.
So it's a way to intimidate and essentially frighten homeless people on the cheap. If this goes through with these two, then the city attorney can threaten others with the same kind of procedure. We don't even have to give you a criminal trial. We can use a civil contempt procedure to go after you.
I don't know if they intend to do that, but it does seem like there is some sort of kind of priming of the pump of this procedure going here, because they are certainly investing a lot of resources.
Anything interesting in the discovery you found that you want to make public that you think would be interesting and helpful for the community to know about?
Yes, there is. The thing that I found most interesting in all of the discovery...
And for those who don't know, discovery means all the stuff you got from the city attorney and the police about this case, or all the
right.
records and so forth.
All the documents that I could possibly think of that might be relevant to this case that, you know, they're willing to disclose anyways. The thing that I found the most interesting was the fact that Santa Cruz has on multiple occasions, as a city entity, government entity, declared there to be a homeless crisis, particularly when it comes to housing.
Shelter emergency.
Right. And so when... And the city's own Homeless Issues Task Force on multiple occasions, as I understand it, from, you know, the limited amount of documents that I've read, has suggested and recommended very strongly that the city repeal this sleeping ban until it improves the services, specifically housing, that it provides to homeless people, and that based on the recent surveys of homeless people in Santa Cruz, the shelter availability is incredibly inadequate to address the needs of the entire homeless community, which in Santa Cruz is quite large. And the fact that there is no shelter between April and November, I think it is, it just seems like it's unfortunate that the city takes this very, very hard-line position against people who are just trying to live. I mean, simply live. You know, they're doing their best to not encroach on other people, but the fact is that when you are a human being, you take up space. When you don't have a home to put things in, you accumulate things. And so, in that regard, what struck me as interesting, looking at all these documents, is that there's a real problem in Santa Cruz in terms of housing for homeless people, and this is the way, apparently, that it's being addressed. And I can't imagine, at the end of the day, that this is going to be cheaper. Maybe it will be cheaper than addressing the core problem, which is housing. But, you know, all of these kind of coastal communities that are in moderate temperatures and, you know, provide space for homeless people that might, that, you know, the city government thinks might be appealing. Santa Monica, Orange County, you know, all those kind of temperate regions. I think that the cities are very, very concerned that if they don't take a very hard line against homeless people, then they are going to be inundated with every single homeless person that, you know,
well, that's what
ever,
Mayor, that's what Mayor Rotkin is, Mayor Rotkin is always saying, that, you know, that millions of homeless people will come, thousands of homeless people will come if we lift our camping ordinance or make it legal for people to sleep in some campground areas. Legally, you know, at low income or no cost, as a response to the housing emergency. And that, of course,
right,
that's not justified by findings in either Miami, Florida, when the Pottinger decision set up safe zones, or in Portland, Oregon, when the Wicks decision eliminated the citywide camping ordinance, or in Los Angeles, when the Jones settlement went into place, or the Spencer settlement in San Diego. So I just don't think that's true, but I think you're right. The fear is there.
Yeah, the fear is there, and the and for that reason, and I guess it's just out of sheer luck of the draw or whatever, or because my clients have multiple citations and are less interested in obeyance to the police in the city when they harass them, they have just become what they feel like is the whipping post. You know, they're like the poster children for everything bad about homeless people in downtown Santa Cruz, and the fact is that they are not violent, they don't do drugs, they don't drink, or if they do, they drink very, very moderately, and they're just trying to exist. If that doesn't appeal to the image that the city's trying to create, or what have you, then I'm not sure, you know, how to address that for them.
Jonathan, what can ordinary people do between now and March 19th when the hearing in Judge Volkman's, is it Department 2 that is going to be having this hearing?
4.
Department 4. Now, what's the time of the hearing? Do we know?
I want to say it's 9, but I'd have to check my calendar, which I don't have in front of me.
Well, what can folks do to be supportive? Should they, I don't know, send emails?
Show up.
But should they send emails to the city attorney urging them that this is a waste of city money, or that it's an unfair process, or that it's just generally absurd considering the fact that people need to sleep, not anywhere and everywhere, but somewhere? Should they be writing to the mayor of Santa Cruz, Mike Rotkin? Should they be addressing their concerns to the judge? What can they do? I mean, people can show up and sit there silently and watch the process happen, for sure.
Well, I don't dissuade people from fully engaging in city government, and that means sending letters and participating and trying to change the law and doing all those things. In terms of this particular case, I mean, I think that that's kind of like yelling at an avalanche to stop once it's already in motion. I mean, the pleadings are in. The case is set.
Perhaps
so in terms of helping them in this particular case, I think that the impact on the judge looking out into his courtroom, which is usually not filled, at least for one particular case, and seeing a broad base of community support, or at least interest, that will compel him to at least be careful. And that I think, will help us. In terms of broader addressing of this issue in the community, yes, all those things that you suggested are good things to do. And I don't, you know, I think that people should also be creative about what they want.
There is a public sidewalk outside City Attorney John Barisoni's office.
That's not, yeah.
I mean,
yes,
there is an opportunity. I mean, city attorney is supposed to be an official to which the citizens of the city have recourse, correct?
The citizen, he is a public officer, and he is beholden to the populace. I would agree with that.
I mean, I would say that if 20 or 30 people with signs outside the city attorney's office saying, where can we sleep, and having a protest, and maybe having a petition of the city attorney to spend city money on other things, would that be interpreted as a form of coercion against our poor city attorney? What do you think?
Well, you're pretty good about that. So I'll let you advise that, and I will attend to my clients in terms of the legal process. You know, when I was in law school, I had just a short anecdote, then I got to go because I got work to do tonight. But I had a law professor when we first started our orientation, And he said, you know, I asked the question, what do you do when the law is unjust? Like, for example, if you have an 18-year-old kid that sold crack and never sold crack before, but did it, and there's no question that he did it, and he's going to go to jail for 15 years, 20 years, for having done this. What do you, as an attorney, do? Because any entrance into that process is just going to cause the ball to continue rolling and your client to go. I mean, the law provides that he's going. And at what point do you, as an attorney, cross the line into what would be civil disobedience or anything else? And he just said, you know, and I'm not sure he's right, but what he said was, you know, as an attorney, that you've got to work within the law to do this, and that, to me, doesn't mean that, you know, everybody else has to obey that kind of strict thing. But if I blur the line too much, at least myself, then I kind of get lost in what my job in this whole thing is. So while you're right, there's the city attorney's office, there's a public sidewalk out there, pressure on him may be helpful. In terms of myself, I think that I am going to, you know, keep hammering away at these pleadings and find how this process really not legitimate.
Well, Jonathan Gettleman, thank you for, you know, calling in and giving us this update. Not the most optimistic update for sure, but about the upcoming trial, I should say hearing, for Ana Richardson and Miguel de Leon on the crime of three instances of sleeping in 3 months, for which they haven't been convicted. They aren't even going to be tried for it, but they're going to be this is going to be used as an attempt to sentence them to 15 days in jail and 240 hours of community service each, and I don't know how many thousands of dollars of fines or fees for the city attorney.
I am confident that that we are going to be successful in this hearing. So I certainly didn't want to give that impression. I think that we've had some, you know, very good legal arguments to make here, and I think that, you know, a fair hearing, they should be persuasive.
We're talking about March 19th, 9 a.m., probably Department 4, but go to indiebay.org/Santa Cruz for more information about that. I'll try to keep these things posted when I get more information from you, Jonathan. Plus, I'm going to post your arguments and Barisone, the city attorney's arguments, so people can judge for themselves who is in the right. There's also an earlier story, anti-homeless injunction against two street musicians, back on May 29th. You can find that by...
Okay, I got to run. Talk to you later.
All right, thanks, Jonathan. By going on to the Indie Bay website. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, www.freakradio.org. I'm Robert Norse. You're listening to Bathrop Spears Broadsides, and the call-in number is 427-3772. Another number from the same group as before. Whoops, let's wait on that. Spare and Change, Sitting Pretty with Mr. Paradise, and that was Morning Song. Again, 427-3772 is the call-in number. And let's go to some street interviews. And I even try to play a little bit from Detroit. That some of the backstage interviews I did when I was at the 13th Annual Homelessness Marathon about a week ago. First, however, some street stuff from our own Santa Cruz.
We're down here on a cloudy Saturday about 5:30 on the
20th of February, 2010, we're talking with
Brianna Brewer.
In front of New Leaf Market. You say you've some contacts at Winston have, shall we say, dispirited you?
Well, I'm honestly being repetitively harassed by the same officer, Winston, and it's unnecessary harassment, to be honest. And
sounds like it's taking the wind out of you.
Basically, I'm really sick right now, to be honest. My throat's just kind of messed up. I've been doing lozenges all day. But anyway, last weekend, it's Saturday now, last weekend, exactly on Saturday, actually, a week to the day, he came along and harassed me on Pacific Avenue where I was selling my jewelry outside of my guitar case and playing guitar on, you know, Valentine's Day weekend, busy weekend. And thank you. And I was reported as handing off something to someone. And so they thought I was
terrorist, drug dealer,
yeah,
stabber.
Some such thing. And they came along and asked me if they could search me, and I, not knowing my rights, told the cops that I told them yes, because I didn't know that I could say no.
You can always say no.
And
they may not.
I gladly know this now. Never going to forget that again. Well, so they searched me, and they find a little bit of weed on me, and they took my pipe and my lighter, and they charged me with possession, okay?
Who were the officers who searched?
Winston, and I don't have my wallet on me right now, so I can't tell you the name of the other officer.
You didn't recognize her.
But Winston wasn't the writing officer, the one who wrote the ticket. He had his partner write the ticket, and actually that happened both days, because Winston came and harassed me the very next day, too. But anyway, let's finish up with Saturday. Saturday, I was, okay, set up with my whole thing, and I sit on an egg crate when I play my guitar, okay?
Where you were here in front of New Leaf?
I was in front of Pacific Trading Company, right down near Rosie McCann's, right next door to Rosie McCann's.
Middle of the day?
Yeah, middle of the day. Okay, and so I'm sitting on my egg crate when this whole thing is happening, and I'm talking to them about the fact that marijuana is practically legalized, and it's pretty much just my medicine. It's not even a couple bowls that they took from me, like hardly anything, you know? And I was just saying, you know, sir, why can't you give me my medicine back?
Right.
I know I'm not a medical patient right now, but I have every intention of being, quotes, legal, and this isn't a drug, to be honest.
What do you use it for?
For pain, to be honest.
What kind of pain do you experience?
I have repetitive nerve tension pain, and I have anxiety as well that it helps amazingly with, and then also menstrual cycle pain.
Okay.
It helps with a lot.
Something I don't experience much.
Yeah. Anyway, so
probably Officer Winston doesn't either.
So they kept approaching me closer and closer and closer, though I made no physical advancement towards them.
We're talking Officer Winston and his
Officer kid. Winston and his partner. I was sitting on my egg crate, okay, and never even stood up to approach them until signing the ticket, okay?
Right.
And they kept approaching me, even basically as close as you are now and closer.
About 2 feet.
Standing over me with their arms crossed or hands on weapons, you know, ready for what? Who knows what?
You might have pulled a piece of an earring, perhaps, and attacked them.
And so I said immediately upon them coming closer and closer that I felt uncomfortable and threatened. And I said this very loudly so that other people around could witness what was happening to me.
And were people watching?
Yes, several people were watching and taking pictures of the event, too.
What did you
and
say?
I said, I'm feeling uncomfortable and threatened, and you need to back away from me, sir, because I am not threatening you.
Right.
You have no right to be coming this close to me. You're threatening me and you're scaring me, to be honest, and you're not making me feel comfortable.
Uh-huh.
And they did not back away. Neither of them backed away. And Winston, you know what he said to me? His retort to me telling him to back away from me was, "This is public space."
That's not an appropriate response either for a private citizen or for a police officer.
Yeah, that's what I said. I said, you know what? You will see me in court. And so the very next day, he actually did the same thing to me. Winston came along with another partner. I was not even 5-10 feet from the exact same place that I was the day before.
What were you doing at both these times at this location?
I was playing guitar for tips and selling jewelry.
Okay.
And I just had
for donation or
yeah,
for
I have my stuff out for donation, and he comes along this day to tell me that I'm within 14 feet of a crosswalk. And that they're going to cite me for it.
First of all, that might be relevant if you are panhandling, but not if you are having a display device such as jewelry or an open guitar
exactly.
case for us. So that's 10 feet, not 14.
And the other thing was, on Saturday, the day before, Winston had told me that that I wasn't in the right place when I was like 5 feet down from that spot, and he told me to move to the spot that I was in the day that they came and cited me for being within 14 feet of
Maybe
a crosswalk.
He unilaterally changed
so
the law.
Technically, he coerced me into being in the wrong place so that he could give me a ticket. It's how it feels in the long run.
That's what we call collateral estoppel.
And then so they come along and they ask me what I'm doing and why I'm doing it there, and I said, you know, I'm playing music, and what's the problem? And they told me that the problem is I'm blocking a crosswalk, of which I can show you the place. I mean, I wasn't blocking the crosswalk. Mm-hmm. I asked a few people about it. I want to take a picture of where I was before I go to court.
Wow. How many tickets were you eventually written by Officer Winston or his partner?
His partner, they wrote me 2 tickets over the course of the last weekend.
Okay,
and so the second ticket was a citation for sitting, quotes, within 14 feet of a crosswalk. Well, I wasn't even sitting on the ground. I was sitting on an egg crate, first of all. And when they told me that I couldn't be there, I willingly, absolutely willingly and politely said, okay, I'll pack up my things and move along to somewhere that isn't within 14 feet of a crosswalk. I said, I didn't know that I wasn't allowed to be 14 feet of a crosswalk, but I knew 14 feet of a building.
I think they wanted you to move to another city, Brett.
Yeah, that's kind of the gist that I'm getting. Anyway, so the officer asked his partner, not Winston. Winston just stands around smirking the whole time.
Right.
Okay, and holding on to his belt and his gun. Well, his partner asks me, where's your ID? And I said, why do you need my ID, sir? I deserve a rightful warning, and I'm telling you that I'm willingly moving, and I'm giving you no problem.
Mm-hmm.
And he looked me straight in the eye and said, give me your ID.
And your response is, should be, well, my name is such and such, my address is such and such, and I'm telling you the truth. If you have a problem with that, I'll give you my thumbprint.
I said, honestly, sir, you don't need my ID. There's no reason for you to cite me.
And what did he say then?
He started to position himself behind me to put handcuffs on me.
Okay, and then what happened?
I pulled out my ID to have the fucker not touch me.
So he successfully...
Pardon my French.
He successfully intimidated you into abandoning the right to identify yourself without photo identification.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is our police department in action. This is the kind of strong action
against
criminals like yourself.
And actually, just after that, as he kept approaching me, physically, and Winston did, closer and closer, I remembered what they'd done to me the day before, and I repeated it. I said, I'm feeling threatened. You need to back away from me. I'm not approaching you physically, yet you are approaching me. Get away from me. You are not... You have no right to be this close to me. And I have given you no right to be this close to me by any action that I've made, was what I said. And Winston again said to me, this is public space. And when I asked them to be quite clear on where you can and cannot stand, you know what the officer said to me? An officer of the law who's supposed to let the citizens know what the laws are and how to follow them? He told me to go to the public library.
Where it's actually hard to find that information anyway.
Yeah, isn't it?
Yeah, it's interesting, particularly since as your account is accurate, he had told you one thing before and then ticketed you for the same thing for doing what you suggested you do. Although I've got to say that I experienced a similar situation from officers in San Francisco when they were giving out statements about where you could get free food with Food Not Bombs in San Francisco. They said, you can come to this particular place where I was serving food as Food Not Bombs. Then they arrested me. The same officer gave out the information then arrested me for serving the food. So it was interesting. Police are more intent on a particular agenda than they are in respecting the rights of citizens often downtown or community members. And it looks like you're getting the brunt of this. Any witnesses to this?
Several witnesses, and I'm going to do whatever I can to fight for my rights. A woman on the day of the possession charge was standing around watching the entire thing, and her husband was a lawyer. And she walked up to me after the whole thing happened and gave me her husband's card and insisted to call him.
Have you called him?
I'm going to, as soon as I have a working phone. My phone is broken right now. But
I'll give you 50 cents. Call him right now.
But I need to call the guy, and I'm going to have him, I'm going to ask him if he can help me to take legal action against Winston, first of all, by reporting him and what he did to me by assaulting me 2 days in a row.
Here's 50 cents.
Assaulting and harassing me.
Call him today, because the more time you leave to speak, this might...
I know.
The memory tends to fade. Like, you need another dime.
I know. I understand completely.
And so if you can't either borrow somebody's cell phone or use a public phone and, you know, give them a contact number, even if you don't have a number of your own, where you can be reached. I'm be out of town for about 5 days. I expect you to carry on, get all the reports of other people being harassed.
I'm working on it. If necessary, I'll file a restraining order against this officer.
Well,
if necessary, if this does not let up.
Anything happened today?
But I'm definitely taking both cases to court.
Anything happened today?
No, not yet. And we are following all the laws right now where we are set up. We're setting up to play music right now, actually.
And
me and my friend Barry here.
Here on the corner. The infamous Barry, well known in song and story.
Right here. On the corner of New Leaf. And we are 14 feet away from the building and 14 feet away from the crosswalk.
You don't have to be 14
feet. For all those who require it of us.
10 feet away from a building is all you need. Unless you're seated on the sidewalk.
I got a ticket from Winnie, too. I got a ticket from Winnie for leaning.
Leaning. And when was this, Barry?
I don't know, a couple weeks ago.
Well, we know that...
leaning up against a railing.
Which way were you leaning?
It doesn't matter. I have cancer. I have super staff, and I tried to get an accommodation under the Americans with Disability Act, which he violated in a felonious manner.
Right.
Somebody ought to shoot that bitch. He ought to be thrown off the force, and he ought to bust rocks forever. The Constitution. Bust rocks forever.
Right.
Intentionally and maliciously, which is a felony punishable by death or life in prison without parole. He's over the line.
Well, Barry, I'll be back, and we'll be hopefully getting more details.
I've got one more thing. And Joseph John Pace deal women, children, and methamphetamine down here. He's an evil little bitch, Winston. And Pace, evil little bitch.
We will attempt to investigate this accusation at a later time. Thank you.
I'm sure you will.
Thank you, Barry. I'll be back.
What enforcement is really doing?
Any reports from the street?
Three weeks ago,
your name?
I'm Nathan Reed. 3 weeks ago, I was intoxicated, and I hit my head on a door and was bleeding. Even though my friend was going to sew the stitches up for me because I don't have health insurance, the cops took me, forced me to go to the hospital, forced me to get stitches, tied me to the bed like I was insane or something. And then when I was discharged from the hospital, they arrested me, took me to the station. The cop was pulling me by my arm, at which I pulled my arm back from him and said, I can walk fine. Next thing I know, I'm getting my face dry humped into the ground while I already have a concussion, and then I get hit with a mag light or one of those, like a billy club or whatever, something right in the ribs. I'm still having trouble breathing. In the Santa Cruz police station, not in the sheriff's, but the police.
What day did this happen?
Let's see here. This was 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, Thursday. So
today is Saturday.
The 20th.
And
today's the 20th.
So it'd be 19th, 18th. So it'd be 3 weeks ago. It would be in the end of January, probably the last Thursday or the Thursday before
last. Yeah, the last Thursday of January.
And
then...
Name of the officer who you... Did you identify the officer who did this?
He was... I can't remember his name right now, but people have told me since what his name is. He's really short. He has kind of like a flat top that's a little slick back, and he's very muscular.
A constant smirk?
Constant smirk. And I told somebody that this guy was the one who beat me up, and he described him to me before I described him.
He didn't say his name was Winston by any chance.
I believe it was. I'll go ask him, and I'll get back to you if I see it, Sub Rosa, about that.
Okay.
But, and then I was held in the drunk tank for 4 hours, and then I was discharged and mocked. And they stole my cigarettes, too, and made fun of me about that, and with no tickets.
Was your property returned to you?
Like a week later. I'm lucky that I have a car, because if that would have been my backpack and I was living out of it, I would have, because it was, like, raining all week, I would have been fucked, man. I would have been majorly fucked.
A good lesson to you, son.
Yeah.
Keep moving. Don't stop in Santa Cruz.
Yes, do not talk to the police in Santa Cruz, especially if you are a free spirit, because they hate that shit.
Again, we've been talking with
Nathan Reed.
Thank you, Nathan. So, Nick, you say you have an additional concern that came up?
Also, while...
And it's not Nick, that's Nathan.
I was being manhandled, I guess, on the ground. They grabbed the center of my handcuffs and pulled them up, like, pretty much almost to the back of my neck. And the next day, my wrists were so swollen that you couldn't, like, delineate where my hands started.
How many officers were involved in this?
Only one, but there were like, probably four other ones around.
Was there anyone who made an objection or said, cool it?
Not that I recall.
Now, you said you were real intoxicated when this happened?
Not when I got beaten. When I got arrested, I was pretty intoxicated. By the time I got out of the hospital, I had sobered up quite a bit.
What lapse of time was there between the time of your arrest, your hospitalization, and then when you went to the police station?
They arrested me real quick because my friend went to go get my other friend, and by the time he got back, I was already gone.
Where was that?
That was on Pacific Street, in front of the bar. Yeah, in front of the bar on the other side of Laurel.
The Asti bar?
Is that the Asti. Right in front of the Asti. And then, then I was in the hospital getting stitches and waiting around for approximately an hour and a half. Then I was in the cop car for maybe 45 minutes. Then I was in the police station where I was beaten briefly. And then I was in the drunk tank in the sheriff's office for about 3 hours.
The jail, you mean?
Yeah, the jail.
Now, were you actually taken to the police station or was it to the sheriff's station?
I was taken to the police station and then the sheriff's station afterwards. And
about what time do you think you reached the police station? Did you see a clock or do you have any memory?
I initially got arrested right around 10 o'clock at night, so I'm speculating 11 to midnight.
Now, did the officer who wrenched your arms up, was he the same one who
struck me? Yes, same officer.
And was there any verbal interaction? Did he say anything?
I don't know. There was a lot of mocking, and I was mocking them. I was definitely antagonizing them. I do not like getting my rights infringed on, and if I'm intoxicated, I'm pretty vocal about it. So, there was definitely a lot of interaction between us and a lot of argument and a little bit of name-calling, things like that, and, yeah, but...
You potty mouth, you.
Yes, I am a potty mouth.
All right, you lush. We'll talk to you later.
All right, thank you.
Write it all down or get somebody else to write down. I know you're giving an account verbally, but...
Don't let them take your rights, man. Don't let them take your rights. Hold on to those. That's all we got anymore.
Thank you, Nick.
And that's about it for Bathrop Spears Broadsides. Just a quick addenda... or addendum, actually. I have gotten a response from Tricia Husum, the records keeper of the Santa Cruz Police Department, in response to a Public Records Act request seeking the documents around the sinister song citations where we were arrested for singing political songs, I should say cited, with $450 tickets apiece for singing political songs outside the bookshop Santa Cruz on January 6th. And I asked for copies of the police reports. I was told they were available at the police station. My co-defendant, Robert Blindbear Facer, a homeless man, went to the police station today to try to get them. He was refused access to those reports. So we'll see how that develops. I'll be back on Sunday to give you more information. That's Uncle Dennis. He's coming into the studio to give you less information and more music. Probably the same old tiresome chanties we've heard these four decades from the 60s and the 70s, plus his ever-popular Booze It Up Winter Ale Chug-a-Lug. That's going to be going on probably soon. So you can join him vicariously or perhaps by calling in at 427-3772. Or you can take the wiser course, keep your eyes on the street, and give me a call at the Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom headquarters, wherever that may be at the moment. But you can leave a message on the phone line at 423-HUFF, 423-4833. And in the event that you just want to listen to this for a few minutes and then just, I don't know, go watch television or maybe join the protest up at UCSC, you can tune in again on Sunday at 9:30 in the morning when I shall most likely be sitting here in the same chair doing the same thing. So, thanks for being with me on this edition of Bathroom Spears Broadsides. 423-4833 again is the off-air number if you want to reach me. And I now commend you and your souls to Uncle Dennis and from the cream to the dregs.
Yeah, I got a story about my Juanita.
freedom. I promise to have her and keep her a teacher. Oye chiquita, quiero volar contigo, tocar tu ombligo y pachanguear contigo. I'm all crazy, heart stop beating as she gracefully whispered in my ear, how long would it take me to get a whole family here safely? She said they were deported back in the 80s. She learned some black magic in Haiti to save me. The way she moved her hips just amazed me. Oye Wahida, so nice to meet you. Next time I see you, we can roll some weed.
My little rush, Butterfly there to open the show tonight on From the Cream to the Dregs. Uncle Dennis sitting in here in the hot seat. For the next 3 hours, we are going to be bringing back the music of the 60s and the 70s. If you want to bring Robert back, you're going to have to send money. We're going to hold him hostage until you send in money. And we're going to make Officer Winston talk to him for hour after hour.
Get away from me, Winston.
Anyway, Robert will be back Sunday morning, 9:30 or so. Maybe sooner. I don't know. We just can't keep him out of the studio. But anyway, I am Uncle Dennis. This is From the Cream to the Dregs, and you are listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1, www.freakradio.org is where you can find our streaming webcasts. Stay tuned. Half an hour, we're going to have our Brew of the Week. And then, of course, at 9 o'clock, the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use. Then at 10 o'clock, our Spotlight Group of the Week, an entire hour of music and history about one group or artist from the past. And then at 11 o'clock, I go off the air, and the Hour of Slack is brought to you right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. So stay tuned. Here's some Jimi Hendrix.
Give my pain to come in. Give my pain to come in. Leave the town, yeah. Be a magic boy. Be a voodoo child. Come back and buy this town.